From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1988, which happens to be the last time that the share of women in the workforce in this country was this low. You might have heard NPR's reporting yesterday on this issue. Women are back in 1988 with a massive number of women pushed out of work during the pandemic. NPR reported, quote, "A growing, prosperous economy depends on a large and committed workforce, with women playing a vital role. If women decide to stay on the sidelines, the very dynamism of the U.S. economy is at risk, as many households lose half of their earnings and productive capacity. This trend could even turn back the clock on gender equity, with harmful consequences to society and the economy," end quote. But there's one part of that reporting that is up for debate. Are women deciding to stay on the sidelines? Journalist and celebrated podcaster Catherine Goldstein says no. Goldstein recently wrote regarding women in the workforce, quote, "Please do not call this dropping out. That's what lazy teens do. This is pushed, shoved, and forced out of work by a society who has abandoned us and given us no livable options," end quote. Last week, a Federal Reserve governor warned that if women remain unemployed at the same rate, the economy at large could be stalled for years. We're talking hundreds and hundreds of thousands of women out of work since March now. A few weeks ago, I read a tweet from Catherine Goldstein. She was responding to news that in September alone, 865,000 women left the U.S. workforce, four times more than men leaving the workforce. Goldstein wrote, quote, "865K women exiting the workforce in 1 month is perhaps the long-term impactful economic story of the year, period. Why are only podcasts and outlets aimed at women and moms inviting me to talk about it?" End quote. It was a fair question. So I reached out to Catherine, who is joining us today. She believes that this is a generational story that needs voices from mothers in the trenches. Let's talk about it. Catherine Goldstein is a journalist and creator of the Double Shift podcast. An honor, Catherine. Thanks for making time for the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Erica Rosenberg is president and CEO of the Center for Governmental Research. Erica, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Evan.
Well, before we even dive right in, there was one thought about what's going on here. I want to listen to some sound from a rally in Michigan. President Trump had some things to say about women who are hurting during this pandemic, and here's how he had diagnosed the problems and what to do about it.
Because women, suburban or otherwise, they want security. They want security. They want safety. They want law and order. They have to have law and order. And we're going to do great. And I love women, and I can't help it. They're the greatest. I love them much more than the men. Much more than the men. So I'm saving suburbia. I'm getting your kids back to school. Get your kids back to school. You know, we won that big Supreme Court case against your governor. So what the hell happened? Why isn't it open? Still not open? You know, we sued. We won the case. What are they appealing? She's appealing the case. Hey, governor, let your state open. Get your kids back to school, governor. Not a good governor. And you know what else? I'm also getting your husbands. They want to get back to work, right? They want to get back to work. We're getting your husbands back to work, and everybody wants it.
Getting your husbands back to work is the president's plea for women. Erica and Catherine, I'll start with Catherine on this. What did you make of that?
That assessment of the economic realities that mothers and families are facing is in no way, I think, rooted in reality. Basically, as we are seeing, mothers are bearing the disproportionate brunt. Women in general, many have dubbed this the female recession, and women and mothers are bearing the brunt of, you know, a virus that is not under control and a society that cannot function while we're in this massive public health crisis. And mothers are being asked to, in uncompensated, basically pick up the pieces of our dissolved social safety net. So I think it's a view of family that's based, that was around maybe more like 60 years ago.
Erica Rosenberg, what did you think of what you heard from the president there?
A lot of different things. One of the things that ran through my mind was that, you know, women want a lot of things beyond security in the suburbs, right? That's a very narrow frame, I think, of what women are interested in. And I was thinking about women also want to see equity in our society and in our communities in many different ways, and opportunity for themselves and their daughters as well as our sons and our husbands and our fathers and mothers. So those are some of the thoughts that went through my mind.
Let me ask both of you if you think, you know, beyond just the NPR reporting yesterday, if you think this story, the story of who is being pushed out of the workforce, is properly sort of understood by both the public at large, I guess journalists, and the policymakers in Congress. Catherine Goldstein, do you think that this story is getting enough traction for people to truly understand what's going on this year?
I think that the reason that this the specific economic toll on mothers and then therefore families is not really getting the traction it deserves is because as a society, we see the issues that mothers face as being niche and not really affecting anyone else. And the idea is that only mothers are interested in problems that mothers have, and that there's a lack of understanding about the interconnectedness to our economy and to how society runs as a whole. So I think it people, you know, for a long time, I've been covering the social and economic issues facing working mothers. And really, you know, maybe up until the pandemic, there's a sense that this is inherently unserious. This is similar to like recipe food coverage or something, or crafting, that what mothers face in society isn't really a serious political and economic topic. So I think that's one of the reasons we're slow to catch on. The story has been slow to catch on, but I do think that we're now that some data is coming out about how this affects everyone, not just mothers, and that this will determine the future of our economy, I believe, for decades, people are starting to wake up to this as a real issue.
Well, I've already got some emails, and I want to turn to Erica with an email from a listener named Sarah, and I'll let our listeners know. We'd love to hear from you, you know, whether this hits you directly or not. And this really does hit everyone. We all know someone who is struggling, perhaps out of work. But I want to hear from you on the subject, especially with women being pushed, working mothers pushed out of the workforce during this pandemic in disproportionate numbers. 844-295-TALK. It's toll free. 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. Or email us, connections@WXXI.org. Sarah says, at first there was something almost peaceful about the change. My kids were home. My husband and I tried to balance their education with our jobs. It was kind of cozy, quiet, challenging, but now it's exhausting. I have no idea how much more we can do this, and if one of us is going to leave work, it's almost certainly going to be me. My question is, what is going to change this? The end of the pandemic? I don't see anything happening in Congress unless I've missed something. That's from Sarah. Erica Rosenberg on the policy side. Sarah's correct that Congress, of course, there was the CARES Act. There's been a lot of debate in Washington about what the next round of policy may look like. It may not come for a while. Senator McConnell has indicated he's not feeling like it's got to get done anytime soon. Even the president's gone back and forth on that. Is it simply right now the end of the pandemic that's going to allow things to sort of resquare with this? Or are there policy ideas out there? Are there policy ideas that should be out there? How do you see that?
Yeah. Great question. So I was thinking when you asked Catherine the question about coverage that I've seen, you know, certainly some coverage of this trend happening, and I'm very attuned to it. So anytime, you know, I see something come across email, I'll make sure to click on it and read about it. But what's not being discussed is exactly what you could just ask about and what the email writer asked about, which is what do we do about this? What are the solutions to it? And I think that they are very broad-based and not really being discussed right now. And I would see the policy solutions as centering around not just supporting women, although I'm certainly happy for anything that does that, but also supporting families. I mean, we just have an economy and a society and government policy kind of throughout that just doesn't do much to support families with children. When you look at countries that have lower child poverty and have less stressed out parents, especially of young children, there are policies in place to do a lot more to support those families economically, tax credits, support for affordable child care, access to quality and affordable child care. We did some work at CGR when the Rochester Anti-Poverty Initiative was getting launched, you know, looking at solutions to child poverty across the country and across the world. And really the policies in places like Great Britain, along the lines of what I just mentioned, are the ones that go the farthest toward reducing child poverty. And that's because they put more income into the pockets of families with children. And that's really, I think, what allows people not only to live comfortably, but to, you know, weather these storms such as the pandemic. I mean, I've been thinking about, you know, myself, my situation as a working mother. And the spring was tough because of how online schooling was being done. But now that we've sort of adjusted to it in some ways, I'm able to make it work because I have an income, you know, that allows me. I'm actually a single mother because of divorce, and I'm actually able to live comfortably and well with what's happening with my children now because I have the income to engage support. I want to give a shout out to my wonderful Liz Santa Maria is the woman that helps me with my children. And, you know, if you are not living near family, if you don't have sort of a larger extended network, you need the income to be able to purchase, you know, this kind of support to make your family work. And we just don't do a lot to help families get to that level of income.
Erica, on that policy side, is it likely now to come from a state-level policy, or do you think that we're heading in a direction where there's a federal conversation, a national conversation, and maybe federal policy aimed at addressing some of what you just laid out?
Well, it's needed across the country, so I would certainly hope to see it at the national level get some discussion. Obviously, the outcome of the election will determine whether that really takes off. It can be funded at either level of government, right? Even local governments can do some things to support families more. But certainly this isn't an issue that's limited to any community or any one state. It's a national problem.
Catherine, what would you say to Sarah and working moms like her who feel like, you know, things are starting to break even for women who haven't left the workforce? She's thinking, if it has to happen, it's going to be me. And what in the world is going to happen that will change this dynamic?
Yeah, I hear so many stories like this and so many kind of cries for help like this. And basically, the first thing I would say to Sarah is, no matter what you choose for your family, what has happened is not your fault. This is a social, societal failure, and your government has failed you. This isn't a personal failure. And we usually see family issues through the lens of personal choice and personal failure. And that's absolutely, I don't think, the right lens, and absolutely not what's going on here. We could make this so much livable, so much more livable for families if we had the political will to do so. I believe we could be giving, even if I think that had the federal government, and still could, given schools the money they needed to do a lot of precautions to open safely, we would have a lot more kids back in school. I think that's still possible even without a complete end to the pandemic. I think that for people who need to be at home proctoring virtual school or changing their responsibilities, providing them with direct payments from the government for doing that. That is a job. Let me tell you, my son is in kindergarten. I was not meant to be a kindergarten teacher. I have plenty of skills, and a kindergarten teacher is not one of them. This is a valuable skill, and the fact that we're just leaving it to parents to somehow figure it out isn't a public policy solution. I think giving families money so they can be less concerned about their finances would reduce the stress a lot. And I think that this could be done on, you know, the city, state, and federal level, although federal level would be the best. I mean, I think, you know, one thought I'd like to put out there is that I believe if primarily men were responsible for virtual school, we would have found a way for schools to reopen safely. I'm not for, you know, opening with no precautions, but I think that's a big part of it. And I think that as a society, we would be valuing the work that people were doing as virtual school. And also employers would be helping out more too. I think employers have been a little bit frozen in what to do to help employees, and they don't know what to do. And I think there are things that employers can do as well.
Let me read some more feedback from listeners as we talk about the context of data that sometimes just looks like blobs of numbers, but these are real families impacted, real Americans, and real women who are impacted disproportionately compared to men during this pandemic. And by the time September rolled around, the job losses in this country, pushed out of work, 4-to-1 women to men pushed out. 865,000 women in September alone. That's four times more than the men pushed out of work in September. Historical data, according to NPR, this is reversing years of gains made by women. In 1948, when the Labor Department started tracking this data, a third of women held jobs. That number had nearly doubled by the late 1990s. The ratio of women working has now fallen below 57% for the first time since 1988. Let me get some more feedback. Alex writes, he says the following. Why are we assuming women in the workforce to increase material productivity is a better social model than the positive contribution of stay-at-home mothers? The industrialization of child care centers has increased poor outcomes for children. The destruction of the nuclear family in worshiping multitasked women has been detrimental to our social good. Maybe this change in the workforce is a good thing. That's from Alex. Catherine Goldstein, I'll start with you.
Well, Alex is wrong about child care centers. High quality child care is actually increases all sorts of social good from all different family backgrounds in terms of, you know, what kids are able to, you know, the lack of social services they need down the line. You know, high quality child care is basically the most the best investment any society can make. So I think that Alex's point really does not factor in the incredible rising cost of having a family since this idealized nuclear family model sort of came about post-World War II. And the nuclear family actually has a lot of both racist and classist ideas. Like it's basically the idea that this is the best way to do family. And that I think what so many families are realizing is that, especially when both parents work, which is largely out of economic necessity, not out of some sort of hobby or interest or sort of sense of personal fulfillment, although many, many people get personal fulfillment from their work, is that two-parent families can't do it alone. We need a more robust community. We need a more robust social safety net. And the idea that everything works out fine as long as you have a dad that goes to work full-time and a mom staying home, you know, making sure the homework is done, that is the ideal way to do things, I think has been really disproven by the just economic realities and the fact that, you know, women are more educated than men in terms of graduating from college. Why should our most educated part of the workforce be forced to leave it?
Erica Rosenberg.
Yeah, hear, hear. I mean, I'm thinking of the David Brooks article in The Atlantic earlier this year titled The Nuclear Family Was a Mistake. And he, you know, it's a very long and detailed and fascinating article, I think. But he's talking about the fact that the nuclear family was never really a good setup for raising children. And that, you know, for one thing, the organization of the nuclear family leads you to the wolves if one or both of your parents struggles with an issue like alcoholism or drug addiction or mental health, or lacks, you know, the required conditions to really take advantage of economic opportunity. So, I mean, I want to have our society be one in which people can make choices that, you know, that fulfill them personally and their vision for their families. So I have, you know, no beef with women or men who choose to stay home part-time or full-time to engage more with their children. You know, a silver lining of the pandemic for me personally has been working from home and just being around my kids more. I mean, I really enjoy that. I'm happy to not be running around as much to meetings and to work and to kids events as I was before. So, you know, I think we all have different capacities and preferences. And, you know, unfortunately, the lack of kind of social and economic supports for families, you know, prevents too many of us, I think, from kind of being our best selves and being able to live the choices that we really, really want to make for how we organize our work and our family lives. And those are, you know, complex decisions, and there's not a one right way to do it. So that's what was going through my mind.
Connections at WXXI.org if you want to share your thoughts. 844-295-TALK, toll-free if you want to join the conversation. 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Erica Rosenberg is president and CEO of the Center for Governmental Research. Catherine Goldstein is a journalist and creator of the Double Shift podcast, which is really great stuff, by the way, Catherine. Let our listeners know more about it if they want to find it and haven't found it yet.
Sure. The Double Shift is a reported podcast about a new generation of working mothers. You can find us on any podcast platform or follow us on Instagram at The Double Shift. And we just started our third season.
All right. Let me continue to work through some response from listeners. A lot of men sending thoughts so far. Phil, and which is okay, by the way, which is okay. We want to hear from everybody.
This issue affects everyone, certainly. So I have no problem with men engaging on this.
So Phil says, it's not just women being forced out of the workplace. Many working mothers, especially those working from home, still have to be responsible for care of the children during the workday while fathers are working outside the home. That's from Phil. I hope that that's clear. I mean, Phil, maybe I haven't been clear enough. A lot of Americans are being pushed out of the workforce. It just happens to be that in the last 7 months, something like 65% of the Americans out of work are women. And in the since September, it's 4-1 women to men. That's what we're talking about. So I don't mean to exclude men, but did I miss something? Catherine, did I miss something there?
So this is a common, this is not the first comment like this that I have heard. So basically, there are dads who have left work full time, you know, left their full time jobs to do caregiving. There's, I think dads are doing more childcare and household work than they were before the pandemic. But all of the studies show that it is not proportionate. And also they are not, you know, mothers are leaving the workforce at a much higher rate. So you, of course, can come up with individual examples that are counter to this narrative. But what we're talking about are large national trends. And, you know, I just think that, you know, I don't know, this might light up your phones, but I feel like the what about dads is kind of like the all lives matter response to this, because it's like we are very much like this is a crisis that is disproportionately affecting this specific group. And we need to understand why. And understanding that will also help us understand all of these different family issues and economic issues.
Sure. And Erica Rosenberg, I just want to kind of emphasize a point that I think some of the NPR reporting was making yesterday, and I think it bears repeating, that there are potential long-term consequences to a shift in the workforce that disproportionately affects women. Because when you've seen, you know, what, a six-decade move away from a third of women working paid jobs to, you know, more than double that, and now that's it's sinking back down to where it was in the 1980s. This strikes me as the kind of thing where when the pandemic ends and maybe we'll have another stimulus and some people will, you know, some companies will hire again. It strikes me as something a little bit more complicated than just, well, do another round of stimulus, wait for the vaccine, and things will go back to where they were. This does appear to me to be sort of ominous in its possible semi-permanence. How do you see it, Erica?
Well, sure. I mean, I think there's a lot of research to show that when women, and probably anybody, but here we're focused on women, you know, are out of the workforce for a time period for whatever reason, either they were laid off or they chose to leave the workforce to help with childcare or some other need, you know, they re-enter the workforce in a disadvantaged place and never really make up that ground in terms of pay, in terms of their status at work. I mean, the other thing I'm thinking about is just the fact that I certainly believe we want all of our workplaces to be as diverse as possible along all dimensions. And so when you talk about taking women out of the workforce, you know, you have a less diverse, less inclusive workplace, and you're losing out. You're losing out on perspectives. You're losing out on insights and intelligence that come with having women and having people of all different backgrounds in the workplace. I guess the other thing I just wanted to call attention to is the racial and ethnic dimension to this. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking at some figures that don't go all the way to September. They go February through June. And again, just to highlight, we're talking about disproportionate effects, not that only one you know, population is affected. But the job loss rate was highest for Black and Latina females at above 13%. It was lowest in that time period for white males, but still 6%. And then white females were at about 10%, which was a little bit better than Black males and a little bit worse than Latino males. So we really do see that women are disproportionately impacted, but particularly women of color.
All right. Catherine, is that why you view this as you've said, a generational story with a possible permanent impact or a semi-permanent impact?
Yes, I think another important aspect of women leaving the workforce, often when mothers especially spend time out of the workforce, they have a harder time getting back in, largely because we don't see care, like time out at, around caregiving, as having any value. So basically, through a capitalist employer lens, we see that as basically they weren't doing anything that helped their job skills. Now, I think personally, I feel like I am the mother of 3 children under 5. I think that that has greatly increased my productivity and executive level multitasking. But we don't technically see that.
No doubt.
By the way, I have 8-month-old twins, so I really live my earth. Mm-hmm. But we don't see that as being valuable. We see that as, mm-hmm. you know, stuff that has no economic value. So a lot of times I think mothers have a really hard time getting back in the workforce, especially at the pay level that they were at. So basically, we talk a lot about the gender pay gap. Basically, it's a pay gap between mothers and everyone else. It's not between men and women. It's between mothers and everyone else. So I think that this is something really important that I think you're pointing out, that it's not just we get a stimulus, the economy gets on track, and everyone is sort of back to normal. It's not just salary. It's also 401k contributions. It's seniority. It's sort of connections, job experience, all that stuff is going to impact. I mean, when we keep talking about this 1988 number, you know, I was 5 years old then. So the idea that like my lifetime of progress has been wiped away in terms of mothers in the workforce, like is really depressing. And I don't think that, you know, a snap of the finger is going to fix this if we don't start really working on this right now.
By the way, as a twin myself, you're the mother of 8-month-old twins. I am so sorry and so much love to you. So much love, Catherine. My God. Let me get Maddie in East Rochester. Go ahead, Maddie.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good. Wish we were talking about a happier subject.
Yes, I'm glad someone's talking about this now because I'm a stay-at-home mom. I chose to stay home before the pandemic started when our daughter was born. I was planning going back to work, but with everything going on, it's hard when you're the default parent to take care of the child. And then you really touched on a point with the nuclear family not working. And do you think this will help stem getting away from that so that, you know, we can get to, you know, that quality of both parents being involved? It is hard to shift from that nuclear mindset when we don't have that tribe raising the family so that, you know, I as a mother would love to go back to work now with our daughter being 17 months old, but someone's got to stay home with her, and that usually defaults to the woman, just, I feel like, community-wise, is from my perspective.
And Maddie, let me ask one follow-up before I kick it over to Catherine. Do you feel like this is going to derail any idea you had of getting back into the workforce for, I mean, we're talking about for now. We keep talking about this pandemic as a society as if it's going to be over in sometime maybe late winter or whenever a vaccine rolls around. Are you thinking that this is going to be a challenge for you well beyond the end of this pandemic?
Potentially, because, you know, I wanted to get back into it. I chose to stay home for a while. I wanted to get back in and keep my foot in the door in the corporate world. But I know this will definitely delay getting back into the corporate world. And I feel like every month and every year you're out of it, man or woman, it's harder to get back into the workforce. So I feel like, you know, even whenever this does come to an end, to a point where we can get the right kind of child care, it might potentially make it hard for me to get back to with more time away from the corporate life, for sure.
Yeah, good luck to you. Let me ask Catherine Goldstein first. Go ahead, Catherine.
Yeah, so this is such an important point. So another point I'd like to, we actually did the whole second season of The Double Shift way back in 2019 was all about challenging ideas around the nuclear family. I'm like a real trailblazer on this topic, but I really think that something that's so important about this question is that, the nuclear family, we talk about that as the traditional family. That is not the traditional mm-hmm. family. For most of human history, we have lived in larger extended families, clans, communities, where child rearing was not a sort of single person exercise. So I think we've really, in the last, you know, second half of the 20th century up until now, seen, like, you know, making it as a nuclear family really the height of success. And I think that we are going to see a lot of reevaluation around that. I think we're going to be seeing all sorts of different living arrangements. I think people are going to be really adopting a sense of chosen family, as, you know, when, you know, because we move around so much, we don't necessarily live next to our, near our biological family members, or, you know, there's all sorts of reasons why biological family members wouldn't be close with, but chosen family and really investing in community, I think is going to be, and I think, you know, we're seeing that during the pandemic, like the friends that you can really count on or the friends you really trust are becoming more and more important. And that's more important than knowing a lot of different people. Having close relationships, I think we're seeing how important that is. So I think another really important part of this last questioner's point is that, which we haven't talked about in this segment, is that the childcare industry is on the brink of collapse. So unless there is also large-scale intervention and an effort to really build back our childcare system, even when the caller is ready to go back to work and has a job opportunity, there might not be any childcare available to her, because so many, basically right now we're at risk of 50% of all childcare spots closing, and the childcare situation was not robust before now. So these are very interconnected issues, and I'm all for people sort of opening up new conversations about how we create family.
Yeah, and Erica Rosenberg, on the subject of childcare, I mean, this county in particular has debated for years childcare subsidies. Who pays for it? How much is New York State responsible for? How much can the county handle? What's the quality of care? What's the level of care? Well, now you've got state and local governments just hammered by this pandemic, and it occurs to me that we're probably a long way away from seeing a possible expansion of funding in just about any way if it's not a federal package. Maybe I'm wrong. What are your thoughts there, Erica?
Yeah, I don't think the county thing with the decline in sales tax revenue is going to have oodles more money to pump into childcare subsidies either. So I think we are looking for a higher level solution than that. And I mean, I think we've just named two systems that don't work, right? The childcare system doesn't work and didn't before the pandemic, and neither does nuclear families, really. I mean, except for some people, right? I think we need either the kinds of things that Catherine was talking about, you know, more community around families, more extended networks to help with raising our children. And that was kind of the point of the David Brooks article that I referenced earlier. Or you need to have income so that you are able to, you know, purchase those needed services in a way that works for your family. And both of those things are really challenging right now. And just two more seconds on childcare. I mean, it was terrifying for me when I had my first child to start looking for childcare. You know, being in that situation where I had visited several, you know, in-home providers and really didn't like any of them. And, you know, there's few worse places to be than knowing that you need to and want to go back to work, and you're not sure that you have the right place to leave your infant. I mean, I think we're talking about changes that have been needed for a long time and hopefully get some renewed attention and action because of the pandemic, you know, throwing it into such stark relief.
Our guests are fleshing a story that really ought to be top of mind as we try to understand the economy, the impact of the pandemic on the workforce, because there is a disproportionate impact on women, particularly mothers of color. And it's been a massive impact over the last 7 months. And based on the recent numbers, it is only getting more disproportionate. If you're just joining us, 4-to-1 is the rate of women leaving the workforce to men in this country since September. That's a huge, huge disparity. Our guests are answering some of your comments and questions via phone and email, and I've got a bunch. Let's get our only break. We'll come back with Erica Rosenberg, President and CEO of the Center for Governmental Research. Catherine Goldstein is a journalist and creator of the Double Shift podcast. We're right back with them and your feedback next. Coming up in our second hour, Jack Dorsey versus Ted Cruz. Social media leaders versus Congress, and a debate about Section 230. That's a set of federal laws that prevent social media sites from being held liable for content they allow or remove from their sites. We're talking about online information, the gatekeepers, who allows you to see what it should look like. We're talking about privacy concerns and a lot more next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let me read some emails. This is from Catherine in Rochester. Catherine says, thank you so much for the show. It is very much appreciated. I think the bigger issue here is, like many other facts that have been laid bare by COVID, inequity in healthcare, the fact that healthcare is tied to a job and a job can be lost, lack of support for working families in our society, lack of support for single parents, disproportionate amount of care that women do in the home for their families to begin with, etc. I think the $64,000 question is, will we have the wherewithal to tackle some or all of these problems when the pandemic is over? And I think one of the reasons that women are turning out to vote in droves is that we are just done with this. We are tired of doing all of this stuff at home, and now we're losing jobs as well. This has been a huge step backwards. That's Catherine in Rochester. Catherine Goldstein, we have at least so far seen in polling what would be a historic gap between women and men in the presidential election. Now, that's just one barometer of how women are feeling about policy, the state of the economy, the pandemic. But Catherine in Rochester says the reason women are voting in large numbers, and you may see that gap hold up, is because of the anger out there over these disparities, and women, in her words, are just done with it. Do you agree with that?
I totally agree. The emotion that I hear about the most from working mothers across the country is rage. And I think so many of us are just filled with rage at our complete abandonment by society and what we're being asked to do and how little it is valued and supported. And I think how that plays out could dramatically shape public policy and the political landscape over the coming decade. I mean, I'm certainly no one to be making political predictions at this, moment less than a week from the end of the election or the end of voting. But I just think that we've often, Bill Clinton dubbed suburban women soccer moms, which I think is like kind of demeaning. It's like all we care about is driving our kids around to soccer practice in a minivan. I mean, I have a minivan, but the new political description coming out of COVID, I think, is going to be much more accurately rage moms, who are much more politically motivated and engaged around changing public policy and how mothers and families are treated in the society.
Erica Rosenberg?
Yeah, nothing to add, really, except to note that, women are not monolithic, of course. I think it's important to recognize that. We don't all see this the same way. There are certainly women out there who support President Trump, who think that society is arranged, quite nicely as it is. So, there's not one way of seeing these issues among any of our groups, and certainly that's true for females as well. But my political experience, my lens on policy, and my personal experience are certainly more aligned with, wanting these changes so that we have more equity, so that we have more choice. Certainly the burdens of raising kids in the society as we have it now, I believe, really strained marriages. It certainly strained mine. I think it makes it harder all the way around for families to be successful. Hopefully, we will see women of all political persuasions and, policy mindsets coming out to vote. That's what our country's about.
Let me read an email from a listener named Jim that kind of sums up some of the pushback that listeners may be feeling about the nuclear family. Because I'll let Catherine Goldstein, who says she's done so much work on this. I for people who are hearing a pushback to the nuclear family, do not assume it just means a rejection of family in general, a rejection of, sort of options of fathers being involved, of mothers and fathers raising kids together. It's not sort of a salute to anything other than sort of the reality that Catherine Goldstein's been trying to describe here. Well, Jim hears it differently. Jim says the nuclear family has been the foundation of Western civilization. These guests are clueless, and clueless is in all caps, Catherine Goldstein. So...
Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Jim.
So go ahead.
So it's always good for, it's always great to be corrected by men on something that I am an expert in. So let me just say that the nuclear family is not the foundation of Western society. The nuclear family is a new construct, basically a post-World War II construct. Now, I maybe perhaps my visions and ideas about this seem pretty radical to some listeners, but I just want to give like further context by what I mean by you know, changing how we think about the nuclear family. I am married to a man, so that is a fairly traditional family structure, and we have three children. But my mother-in-law lives five blocks away, and she is very involved in helping us care for our kids. We also have a caregiver that lives with us, so we have a third adult. And so that, you know, and my parents live 20 minutes away from us. So to me, that is also a challenge of the idea that, you know, I don't feel that I can do this alone and be have my kids be happy and successful, me be happy and successful. We need all sorts of different people involved. It doesn't mean that mothers and fathers don't provide something really important or that marriage is bad. Marriage is a wonderful choice for people who are happy to be married. It's really just like, let's think, you know, extending the nuclear family is like, maybe you have a really great relationship with your next door neighbors and you guys trade childcare. That is a rethinking of the idea that everybody is on their own. So, but also, you know, I think that there's also religious ideas that, you know, marriage and a man and a woman raising kids is, you know, the traditional way to do it. But again, you know, traditional can mean a lot of things. Traditional is actually not, you know, it involves like your aunt living down the street. It involves, you know, living in multi-generational families. That is traditionally how families across the world have lived.
Yeah. So on that note, I'll read one more of Jim's remarks on the subject. He says, your guests are talking about how hard it is to find someone else to care for their own children so they can go back to work. If you're lucky enough and make the decision to have a child, why in the name of all that is holy would you be seeking out other people to care for your child?
I can keep going, or I don't know if Erica wants to step in. Or
no, go ahead. I mean,
okay. One of the huge problems I believe that we have with how America sees family is we see it as having children as an individual project and an individual decision, not a social good. So for society to function, we need people to have children. We also live in an economy where we need to earn money and we need people to participate in the labor force. The idea that if you don't want to spend it, or the idea that either you choose to or are not financially able to spend 24/7 with your children means that you shouldn't have children basically means that excludes most people in the world from having kids. So you might say, oh, well, that doesn't, like, who cares about, you know, I don't care if you have kids. Who's going to pay into your Social Security? Who is going to staff your nursing home? Who is going to be the doctor treating you when you are in your 70s and don't have any children to come visit you? All of these things, like, our society cannot function if people don't have children. And our rabid anti-family policies, like the complete lack of family policy, make it so individually difficult to have children when there are public policy solutions all around the world that would make it so much more livable to have children rather than sort of being taken on as an individual choice, an individual problem. Society benefits when children thrive, you know, pay for early childhood education instead of paying for jails. Like, all of these things matter. And so this whole thing about, you know, it's all on you, I think is one of the most damaging American ideas, like American mentalities that I think have such a terribly negative impact on families.
Yeah. I mean, listeners who are pushing back, Catherine's correct on the history. The nuclear family is still a relatively modern construct. That doesn't mean that marriage didn't happen, but it meant that there was an extension of options for childcare that went beyond just the mom or just the dad. That was traditional, common, and certainly very healthy. And Catherine is just arguing that in modern times, we've really limited the options for parents, and the policy has reflected that. Well, Ruth is asking, let me read Ruth's email. She says, thanks for this great program. I especially appreciate the discussion on the need for policy change. What steps can individuals take to most effectively advocate for policy change, and what changes can or should happen at the employer level? Let's ask both of you. Erica Rosenberg, you want to start? That's from Ruth.
Sure, and I guess I also want to address Jim's question with a question back to him, which of course he can't answer, but that question of why would we have children and then look for somebody else to take care of them, I'm assuming he means that question to go to fathers as well. It seemed like maybe the assumption was that question only goes to mothers, so that of course is on its face, not fair to put it only to one half of the equation. In terms of policy change and advocacy and what we need to be doing with employers, I think these policy changes can be advocated at every level. I think they'll be more successfully advocated at the state and the federal level. And I think there's lots of, legislation that's been, at least some legislation that's probably been proposed around increased support to make childcare affordable and accessible and at a quality level. And there are, many candidates and, some of the parties, of course, that support policies like increased tax credits for parents and for families with children. And increased minimum wage is another way, of course, to get more income into people's pockets so that they can make more choices around this. I guess thinking about employers, this is an area where I would hope that the pandemic is teaching us as employers that we can be more flexible with our employees, and that certainly that's one of the things we found at CGR. We're a relatively small organization. We have, fewer than a dozen full-time employees, but many of them are parents, and many of them have, like I have, kind of appreciated the flexibility. We're all still working from home and still able to get our jobs done and be quite productive and successful. And I think, for myself as an organizational leader, it's really shown me that we can, even after the pandemic ends, be more flexible going forward with how we structure our work day and what kind of flexibility we allow all employees, including parents. So that's one way that I think maybe employers can open their minds and increase their support for parents and for families is to, recognize that we really can be more flexible about making people be in the office.
Okay. Catherine Goldstein.
So I love this question, and I think the first thing I'd say is I would really encourage the listener to understand that these large-scale systemic changes take time. And so find an issue that really speaks to you on these topics and stick with it. We actually just released an episode about a ballot initiative in Multnomah County in Portland, Oregon, where for years they've been working to get universal pre-K for 3 and 4-year-olds on the ballot, and it's on the ballot this November, and it took them years to do it. I think I don't know all the nuances of your the situation in your area, but I think that's going to be funded by a marginal tax on earners over $200,000 a year. So there's a lot of different creative ways and sort of figuring out. I do think federal is the best, but there are ways to make a difference in your local community. And something like getting universal pre-K in your community can make a humongous difference for parents, kids, parents of color, the entire, children of color, the entire community, really. And on the workplace front, I'm a little hesitant to sort of say like flexibility is the key because, it was one thing back in March where everything was just completely chaotic and everyone was being very forgiving. But now that this is going on for a lot longer, saying, oh, you can do your full-time job at any time, and the only time available to you is between 10 p.m. and 3 a.m., I don't really think that's sustainable. So I think that we have to I think the best thing employers can do is direct childcare payments to people with children. Like, that is the fastest solution right now, if they're interested in supporting parents and keeping especially women in the workforce. That would make the biggest difference in a short-term effect. And I think that as I've seen in my reporting on paid family leave, like, these issues can be catching. Like, if you can get, you can advocate, you know, bringing groups together to advocate for your employer for change is really the most effective way rather than using only one person. And I think that we can, you know, once industries start doing certain things, like other companies are, you know, realize that they, as a competitive advantage, need to do these things as well. So my advice would just to be like, find your issue and stick with it and realize like change does not happen overnight, but that you can make a difference, especially in your local community.
Got a number of emails we don't even have time for. Mary in Rochester, thanks for a really thoughtful email on policy ideas. There's just a lot coming in here, and I know this subject touches so many people. Catherine Goldstein is the journalist and creator of the Double Shift podcast. And listeners, you can find her in her podcast. Where, Catherine?
You can find the Double Shift on wherever you get your podcasts, and our website is thedoubleshift.com, and you can follow us on Instagram at thedoubleshift.
Hey, thanks for saying yes. Thanks for pushing us all to keep this top of mind, and thanks for coming on the program, Catherine.
Thanks so much for having me.
Catherine Goldstein. Erica Rosenberg, President and CEO of the Center for Governmental Research. I always feel smarter after the conversation. Hope that lasts. Erica, thank you. Really appreciate the expertise and the time.
Thanks, Evan.
All right. Much more connections coming up after this short break.